The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
Coming to you from the Curtis Subaru Studio. Welcome. Welcome to The Big Show. It's the start of a new week, the dawn of a new era. This is a lot of fun, man. The Seahawks, the way they're playing in these contentious times. And I've said it so many times that when everything seems to be divided, there are two things that consistently can bring a community together. And one, sadly, is tragedy. And one is sports and triumph. And when you see the ratings that the Seahawks are driving right now, and we had so much fun yesterday. I am so blessed to be able to hang out with all my buddies and chronicle these games on the air. And then the way the team's playing, 5-1, where all of a sudden they're in the conversation after just 6 weeks, still early, but they're in the conversation to be one of the best teams in the conference, and that can mean great things in the postseason. So we're going to talk with our buddy Michael Bumpus, who talked to Pete Carroll this morning on 710 ESPN. We'll do that at 12:30 this afternoon, but let's give you a little preview of what is to come.
The Big Lead, top story.
Because yesterday, 20-6, the Seahawks were trailing, nothing was going their way. But then they started getting interception after interception after interception.
Play fake. Looking, throwing to the end zone. Ball's tipped up. Ball's picked off in the end zone. Coming out of the end zone, Tedrick Thompson going to get a block near sideline. Shoved out of bounds across the 10-yard line. Tedrick Thompson comes up with another biggie.
And then you have Russell Wilson, who right now is the NFL most valuable player. 14 touchdowns, zero interceptions. He's thrown 207 passes without an interception. That's a Seahawk franchise record. It's the longest streak in the NFL currently. You got a running back who's bringing back images of beast mode.
Hand off inside. Carson makes the first man miss. 40, 35, 30, 25, 20, 18. Knocked off his feet. Chris Carson explodes for a big run over the right side and runs right through the Cleveland defense for 25 and a first down.
Just slamming through people. So it was a lot of fun. Seahawks won it yesterday, 32-28. Pete Carroll did his first conversation since they returned from Cleveland. It was this morning on Danny and Gallant, and Michael Bumpus was part of it. Michael Bumpus is going to join me at 12:30 this afternoon, and we'll take you a little more in-depth on that. All right, other news to talk about next in The Big Lead.
The Big Lead, big local.
Okay, then we do have, and the reason it's nice that we have the pure joy of something like the Seahawks is because we do have so many stories around here of tragedy these days. And one of those tragic storylines is the fentanyl that is on the streets that are killing our kids and our adults. And a family in Ballard, and the reason they spoke to the media, no doubt, is because they want everybody to know about, you don't have to have a kid who's been obviously going down a dark path and you've had warning signs. They described their son, the kid's name, Gabriel Lilienthal, and his parents talked to Q13 News. And it just rips you apart when you think about this. But they told the story of their son being a 17-year-old straight-A student at Ballard High School. They describe him as hardworking, compassionate, adventurous. The dad's from Australia, and Gabriel had plans next year to go to college in Australia. Wanted to pursue a career in business and finance, and I watched. It was just a beautifully touching, horribly sad story that Q13 News did. But the father talked about that this son was the center of their universe.
He was my sun, my S-U-N. He was my moon, and he was all my stars together.
And I know that every parent can relate to that. And they said that there just weren't any signs with this kid.
hang out with his dad, go for a walk with me, play with the dog. Like, this wasn't a kid who was, like, out partying, out, like, hanging out, like, very often at all.
He was not just monitored, but he was connected with us. Either his mom or me, we were connected all day, every day. And it's leaving a great hole in our lives. And it's going to be something really difficult to fill that hole.
And the reason they're talking is because they did want parents to know that this could indeed happen to anyone.
It's not like we were like, oh, my God, our son is addicted to opioids and what are we going to do? And we need to get him in rehab for this. It was like, what? Yeah, this wasn't something that we were aware that he was at risk of.
These are drugs that can kill you and kill you really quickly, like Deborah was saying.
And they think that their son, because of when he took this deadly fentanyl, they think that it wasn't even for the rush or the high, but that he could sleep. And, you know, if you have hard-charging kids, more children than ever have sleep issues these days, and they think that's what was going on here.
Well, he took the pill at 2:30 in the morning. He was up. He was awake. He couldn't sleep. He was texting, Snapchatting with a friend of ours in Minnesota. It was later for him. And, he's just trying to sleep.
And that is so sad to hear. And again, we're not just talking about kids whose parents have abandoned them and parents are using drugs themselves. We're talking about kids in normal families who are just falling prey to this. And there's too many of these drugs on the street. I've talked about the connection between... I'm going to try to get a woman on the show, a journalist named Heather McDonald. And I'll get this linked up on my blog when we get her on the show. We've already put in the request. But she spent a lot of time on the streets of San Francisco. And the parallels between San Francisco and Seattle are absolutely frightening. But she points out, as well as any print journalist, and I happen to share most of the things, and I've said for years most of the conclusions that this journalist has reached. But she said that, you know, a lot of people view, and this is completely unconnected to the Ballard High School kid or the other children around here. I don't want anybody to think I'm making a connection. I'm talking about the larger issue now of homelessness and drug vagrants on our streets. But what she said is most people misunderstand this as a problem of poverty, when in reality, it's a breakdown of families. It's the erosion of social norms. And she said it's the false narratives about this being a housing problem, because that's how we're approaching it here. Housing first. That's their new mantra. When Durkin and the city council and Dow and the county council talk about this, housing first, which is just absolutely the wrong approach. And I've been talking about this for a long time. The problem is not a lack of housing. The problem is that it's about drug addiction and mental illness. And ending the street vagrant lifestyle is the only way that we're going to make a dent in this problem. She talks about how the victims are small business owners who are made to work around people who colonize their front stoops and leave feces and discarded needles. And the people, the advocates, who have the loudest voice in government, they champion, for bizarre reasons, only the interests of drug users and drug dealers and people who are flouting the law, Heather McDonald says. She did an interview with Quillette this weekend. And she says, how do you stop this? You simply do not allow the behavior. It's not compatible with a healthy city. And once you establish that, and by the way, 50 years ago, the police would move people along. There was unanimity that if you're in public, you'd have to meet basic norms of public behavior. And there's a lot of cities that still employ that attitude, and they don't have the problem. The other question Heather McDonald asks, when someone ends up on the streets in Seattle or Everett or Tacoma or Bremerton, you name it, if they've come here from Arizona or Texas or Kansas because they've heard about how we've legalized drugs in King and Snohomish County, why do we, the taxpayers around here, why do we have a moral obligation to provide housing to that person who just came up here from Arizona because drugs are legal and shoplifting is not enforced? When did it become our moral obligation to provide housing? So, what are the solutions? Instead of spending, you know, $500,000 per unit for housing for street drug vagrants, you instead spend that money on addiction and mental health services, and you don't do it in the city because they invariably have to walk through drug deals to get to their drug counselor. And you can't stay clean that way. So you put the addiction and the mental health things in either industrial or rural areas. And yes, you can build housing for a fraction. You give them cots and you help them get off the substance. You give them the mental health treatment that they need. You don't make them walk through. I mean, this is the insanity of heroin injection death sites that they want to do in Seattle and King County. All that's going to do is expand the problem. It's going to attract more heroin addicts from around the country here. And it is time for tough love, because that's what's compassionate. Heather McDonald says, if compassion is making excuses and lowering standards, defining deviance down, then yes, it's excess compassion that's causing this problem. A couple other points. This is just one of the most brilliant pieces I've ever read. She said, there are all these West Coast cities where you can just come and hang out. People have no incentive to keep their behavior and temper in check because there's always that escape valve. If street living is not an option, you have to change your behavior before it provokes a crisis. It's also a breakdown of the family. And again, we have society that normalizes the breakdown of the family. We put daycares in high school, which send the message that teen mothering is just an ordinary rite of passage. Now, it's generally a greatly increased path to poverty and probably the poor choices that accompany that. For social workers, they have a financial incentive to have more social breakdown because then there's more jobs in the nonprofit sector. And in the homeless industrial complex, there are a lot of people making six-figure jobs. Right now, we have an economic ideology that benefits more drugs and homelessness. And then finally, Heather McDonald. Her piece is in City Journal. I'm quoting from the interview she did with Quillette, and it's just one of the most brilliant I've ever seen. What she said was, we need a revalorization of males and a rebuttal of the feminist bromide that strong women can do it all. Certainly there are heroic single mothers who are beating the odds and raising self-disciplined, law-abiding children, but the odds are ideally children need their mother and their father. And recognizing that truth means admitting that men and women are different and that fathers, on average, bring different skills to child rearing, competition and an appetite for risk are disproportionately, but not exclusively, male traits and should be revalorized. And mayors need to give police the authority to enforce the laws, including immigration laws. Many of the Honduran drug dealers in San Francisco are here illegally. So how do we get here? Part of it is capitalism's remarkable affluence, she says, that gave adolescents independent spending power. Corporations targeted that new market by creating a mindless consumer culture centered around adolescent rebellion. There's been an incredibly corrosive force to parental authority. And it's also the idea that holds that favored victim groups should not be held to a universal code of conduct. It is so brilliant. In other words, everything that we are doing, everything societally is wrong. Everything we are doing is contributing to the destruction of society and of individual lives. And why? Because the more lives that are destroyed, these are my words now, not hers, the more lives that are destroyed, the more power and control government has. And sadly, that's the ultimate goal here. And so everything we are doing is wrong. I will work to get Heather McDonald on the show in the days to come. That is your big lead for today.
The big lead on Cairo Radio.
Okay, now we'll lighten things up again and talk about something joyous. The Seahawks yesterday improved their record to 5-1. Michael Bumpus was part of a trio that talked with Coach Pete Carroll this morning. We'll hear about that. Michael Bumpus joins me next here on the Dory Monson Show. Well, it is Monday afternoon, and that means it's time for a weekly conversation with... I still don't know what to call this. I know what to call you, Michael Bumpus. You're Michael Bumpus. But I used to call this the Monday Monson Quarterback with Brock Huard. That doesn't make any sense at all with you. What do we call this thing?
I don't know, man. We were supposed to think about this, right? I think we're slacking right now. We'll figure it out next week.
Okay. One listener suggested Bump and Run.
Bump and Run? I kind of like that.
I didn't mind that. Yeah. So, okay. So we'll still put out some ideas for our Pete Carroll Monday morning interview that they do there on 710 ESPN Seattle, the recap that we do. That was fun yesterday. I had a good time.
Yeah, it was an eventful game. These guys go down 20-6 to start it off, and you know, we talked about it in the room, Dory. We weren't really concerned. We were concerned, but we weren't scared. We never felt like we were out of this game. And they found a way to pull it out. Defense made some plays. Offense made some plays. Russell Wilson has the ball with time left on the clock to win the game. So we felt pretty good towards the end of that game.
The thing I like about that, and you're a high school coach. I did a lot of coaching. I always knew if I was down in a game that we were going to come back, and I knew about when it was going to happen, and you just get a feel. You get in a rhythm with your team. Do you experience that yourself?
Yeah, you do. You know, you can tell the identity of the game. You know, and I think the Hawks felt that. You know, they knew that, okay, we've given up a big play on special teams. We shanked the punt. We've given them a short field. There's nothing they've really done to put that type of pressure on you. And you're right. If you're coaching in a game, you're a part of a game, and you feel like the opposition hasn't really done anything to, I guess, deserve this lead, you always feel like you have a chance to get back in it.
Yeah, and you know that Pete Carroll feels that way. And one of the plays that helped turn the game around yesterday was this one.
Jamie Gillen, the punter. Oh, oh, it's blocked! It's blocked! The Seahawks get on it at the 20-yard line! David Moore gets in and blocks the punt. And you got to think that Brian Schneider, the Seahawks special teams coach, saw something in Cleveland that said, we have a chance to get one today. Malik Turner recovers it. The Seahawks are in business.
How much fun is it, Michael, as a coach, when you see something that you think is going to be there in a game, and then it actually is.
It's beautiful, Dora. You kind of see it when you line up. You know, I guarantee you during that play, the special teams coordinator got the look that he wanted. And before the ball was even snapped, he's telling somebody, hey, we got a chance here. Hey, we got a chance here. So to see your guys go out and execute it, you can have all these ideas and what you should do in certain situations. But end of the day, you still got to line up and you still have to execute it. So for a coordinator to see your guys line up correctly and then execute it, there's no other feeling like it.
Yeah, Pete Carroll loved it too.
Block punt was really a cool play to get that done. It was great orchestration by Brian Snyder and Larry Izzo and those guys to get it. They had it drawn up perfectly and it hit exactly like we wanted to. We got 3 points out instead of a touchdown, unfortunately. Those are the plays that jump out.
But the thing that really struck me about your guys' interview with Pete this morning, Michael, was just what we talked about at the very beginning, and that was how the Seahawks have culturally a language. They coach that we're going to be okay, that we're going to stay the course. We're not going to try to panic to come back from a 20-6 deficit. And Pete talked a little bit about that too.
We spend a lot of time on what it takes to perform really well, you know, in difficult times, and we try to create those opportunities, and we're in the conversation a lot. We've got language for it. Our guys are not unfamiliar with what it's going to feel like when it's going to be hard and tough and all that. I think we're poised there because of the preparation. We'll continue to get better at it, but there's no question that this is not a foreign, you know, kind of area to be in for us. And our guys aren't looking for answers. They know where we're going. They know what we're going to do. They know how our language is going to be. And normally, your actions follow your language in the statements that you make. And our guys are very clear about coming back and getting through it and hanging to the end.
As I was listening to that, Michael, I was thinking, I can't wait to talk to Pete more about that on Friday when I have him on, because I would imagine it's really tough if you're a first-year coach and you haven't won national championships and you haven't been to two Super Bowls. It's tough to get players to buy in if you haven't done anything yet. But when you have the kind of pedigree that Pete Carroll has, when he says something, you'd be a fool to not listen and pay attention.
Yeah, Pete Carroll and Kitchens are in two totally different boats right now. You know, Kitchens is trying to establish that culture. Now, don't get me wrong, Pete didn't just come here and that culture came with him. You know, he had to hire the right people. He had to say these words of affirmation. He had to get the assistants to say it. Then you get your captains to say it. Then you get your young guys to say it. And really, he's doing it all over again because we lost the Legion of Boom a few years ago. So it's something that happens over time. And when everyone is in, he kept saying the word language. When everyone's speaking the same language and you're riding the same wave, you have the same vibe, when you get in these moments, it seems real. It doesn't seem fake. You're not just saying it to say it. You're saying these things because you've done it all week and you truly believe in it.
And not only do you have to create that culture, but at any level, there are going to be some guys who don't buy in. And you got to get rid of those guys. If they're never going to buy in and if they are going to have the bad body language or just make it clear that they aren't going to play your way, you got to be willing to cut them loose.
Yeah, you got to be willing to let them go no matter how good they are, no matter how young, how old they are. You have to be a part of this mission. And Pete Carroll does a great job of that. You can kind of feel it. You know, like when they were down 20-6, their sideline didn't look to panic. When I looked at the Cleveland Browns sideline after that fumble on the goal line, it was like chaos. You know, when there's a bad call against Landry on that blindside hit, it was chaos. And there's no calm to the storm. There was just everybody reacting emotionally because it seems like there's no foundation on belief and believing that you can fight through this kind of stuff. So to see the Seahawk team keep their cool and always seem confident is great, especially when you're down, you spot them 20-6.
And when it was 20-6, they did start coming back. Plays like this helped.
Russell takes the snap. Here comes the blitz again. Russell gets rid of it. Back corner of the end zone. It's Jerron Brown. He's in. Touchdown, Seahawks.
And, man, I rewatched that last night, Bob. Russell got drilled. He got drilled on that play and still didn't alter the throw or anything. That's incredible.
Yeah, he got drilled and he knew he was going to get drilled. You know, you're standing there and you're watching this linebacker, Dean, whoever it was, is barreling right at you. And for him to stand there and deliver a ball, he could have done that with his eyes closed, honestly, because at that point it's just, okay, I'm going to pick a spot. I know what coverage they're in. I'm going to try to hit JB on this corner route. Right now I'm just throwing a spot, and I have to hold onto the ball long enough to allow him to get out of his break. And I think Russell got hit this game more than he's been hit all year. This was a grinder for Russell.
Yeah.
You watch the coach film, you see him. He got put on his butt a few times, but that just shows the toughness of Russell. Any quarterback, you can stand there and you see a guy coming at you, you know you're going to get hit, and still deliver a dime. That shows a lot of toughness.
207 passes without an interception. That's a team record. It's the longest current streak in the NFL. And this team's just, they are just flowing right now. 5-1. Got a winnable game Sunday. It's going to be a tough game against Baltimore. But Pete Carroll told 710 he loves the mentality.
The mentality that we're promoting is that you don't have to do different things in these situations to make the results go the way you want. What you have to do is you have to do what you know how to do regardless of what the elements are around you. That's the discipline challenge, and we're really clear about how that works. You just have to keep doing things right, and you have to do it longer than the other guys. And the other guys will usually falter, and they won't be able to hang with you, and you outlast them.
I just think that's a cool, great message. So great place for the Seahawks to be. What was it like at home last night? You got home 3 hours earlier than usual.
Yeah, 3 hours early, but my family is gone. They're in Oregon right now, on the Oregon coast. We rented out a house for them. My wife has been holding the family down for so long. She needed a vacation, so got her out of there. It was nice just to come home, chill. Missed the noise a little bit, but I can't complain.
No, you didn't.
I'll miss it more tonight, Dory.
I remember when my wife would take our three little girls were like 2, 3, and 6, and she'd take them down to her parents for a couple of days. Michael, you know I love my wife, and you know I love my daughters. But oh, I love those nights.
Hey, you can walk around a little loose at the house with no kids. I do have a dog though, so I still have some type of responsibility.
Oh, good for you! All right, love it. All right, Michael Bumpus, bump and run.
Bump and run. I like that.
I kind of like that too. Yeah. I think that's going to be that's going to stick. Okay, Michael, I really had fun with all you guys yesterday. Thanks for popping on today, and I will see you Sunday for that Ravens game.
All right, Dory. See you then.
All right. Michael Bumpus joins us every Monday here on the Dory Monson Show. You got some thoughts, you can text us 989-973. We have lots more straight ahead here on the Dory Monson Show. So I didn't have a chance to watch any of the Sunday news shows. I mean, the Seahawks broadcast started at 7 o'clock yesterday morning, for crying out loud. But I had to get caught up because that's my job. It's my gig. So Chuck Todd on Meet the Press, he said that there was a Trump rally a couple of nights ago. I did not see the rally. But Chuck Todd went on his Sunday show, and he said, "We are not going to show you part of the Trump rally."
Welcome back tonight in 2020 Vision. President Trump held a campaign rally in Minnesota last night. There are parts of it we can't show you, or rather, there are parts of it we're not going to show you. The president's red meat vitriol wasn't new. Neither was his use of profanity, or his railing against the media, or his attacks on Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, or his anger at the, quote, insane impeachment witch hunt. None of that should go unremarked on. Because the idea that the President of the United States is doing all of those things on a regular basis is actually quite remarkable. We're just not shocked anymore. And the fact that we now expect the President to act that way when he's in front of a crowd of his supporters, that's also remarkable, not unremarkable. But what is even more remarkable about what happened at last night's Trump rally?
Uh-huh.
The President went further than he's ever gone before. So we are going further than we've ever gone before to say we aren't going to play the sound. We aren't going to repeat the president's vicious attacks on Hunter Biden. The president of the United States stood in front of...
Okay, now what does this do? All it did for me, and I guess it wasn't the Sunday show, it must have been their in evening Meet the Press, but all it did was, what'd Trump say about Hunter Biden? Because I'm sure it's no worse than what, say, Samantha Bee said about Ivanka Trump when she called her a feckless C-word. And that seemed to really amuse all of the people in the media. And they didn't have any problem playing the bleeped version of that, even though it was going after a president's kid. But Ivanka, you know, is also part of the administration, and they all said, well, that's fair game. Well, Hunter Biden was using his dad's vice president. So anyway, Chuck Todd goes on and on about how horrible it was.
A crowd of supporters and character assassinated a man. Whatever you might think of his decisions, he's not a public figure. He isn't running for office, and he's not a campaign surrogate. He's not even on the campaign trail. And he isn't in any way asking for this attention, obviously.
Okay. I don't know that Ivanka was either when she was called the C word by one of his media colleagues. So anyway, it just made me curious. So what in the world did Trump say that got Chuck Todd so upset?
Joe's son, Hunter, got thrown out of the Navy, and then he became a genius on Wall Street in about 2 days. By the way, whatever happened to Hunter? Where the hell is he? Where's Hunter? Hey, fellas, I have an idea for a new T-shirt. I love the cops, but let's do another T-shirt. Where's Hunter? Where is he? Here's Hunter being examined by Sleepy Eyes Chuck Todd or some of these people. Hunter, it's so great that you're here, sir. Hunter, I know they're giving you approximately $168,000 a month. I hear they paid you a big check of $3 million. I just want to speak on behalf of NBC, who's absolutely one of the worst. I just want to tell you, Hunter, I just want to tell you, I couldn't be happier for you and your family. And I know you don't know anything about energy, and I know it's an energy company, but I think they made a great deal, Hunter.
Oh, so I don't think Chuck Todd was upset because of what was said about Hunter Biden. It was because there were a couple of digs at Chuck Todd's network, NBC. And by the way, speaking of which, the more I am reading about these NBC executives and how they enabled Matt Lauer to be a serial sex abuser of women because money was all they cared about, how they tried to bury the Harvey Weinstein sexual abuse of women because money was all they cared about. Yeah, I'd say NBC's fair game. And frankly, Hunter Biden taking advantage of his dad's vice presidency with his fake jobs, that's fair game. Hey, Chuck Todd, loosen up, dude. Fast 15's next.